Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 192, featuring Kevin Margo and Darren Ross. This is a very special episode for me. Today, the timing of this podcast is very, very purposeful, is when we released the full Construct short. There was a teaser that came out about 5 years ago, a little under 5 years ago, and that is sort of when we started this Construct project. And it took 5 years to get it done for a variety of reasons, which we get into in the podcast itself. But being able to be part of this process was really, really important. Kevin and I have become very close friends in that time, and a lot of things happened. We learned so much. We learned about technology. We learned about different ways that we want to do things. We learned about the art of making movies and how to navigate through the process in Hollywood and everything. And it took Kevin a lot of time to do it. And honestly, actually, the short was done about two and a half years ago. It just takes that long to get that extra thing that you need. It's very complicated, but now we can release it. You can see it out in the public. So for those of you who are listening to this and say, boy, I should watch this short before I listen to the podcast, I recommend you do. The short's not that long, but it's really, really, really great. I always end up crying at the end of it. It's pretty powerful. that being said, I am actually recording this podcast from Valletta, Malta. Yes, I am in Malta. And if you're wondering where Malta is, it is a small island country, pretty much smack dab in the middle of the Mediterranean. And it is pretty interesting and really, really beautiful. And the reason I'm in Valletta, Malta is because I am attending THU, which is Trojan Horse Was a Unicorn. And you're saying, okay, I've heard you talk about this before, or maybe you haven't. And what is that? THU is really kind of an experience that takes about a week to get through and that you come out completely transformed. That's kind of the idea. It's not a conference, although some people could say it kind of feels a little bit like a conference. It's not an event because it's bigger than an event. It takes 7 days and there's a lot that happens during that time. It is really an experience, and that's something that I really kind of admire. There's some incredible people who have come here and were speakers here, which are better known as knights in the THU lingo, because the attendees are called warriors and the speakers are called knights. And it's kind of cool. Well, the cool thing is that I was also hosting panels while I was here, some pretty cool panels about the bridge between technology and creativity, and I thought they were pretty interesting. One was on tools, the other one was on humans, or digital humans, and the third one was on AI. And I recorded those as podcasts. Besides those three podcasts, I recorded an additional 5 podcasts. So I have 8 podcasts. That's, I think, my new record at any event or conference that I've been to. So pretty cool, although I just told you guys it's not an event or a conference, it's an experience. But nonetheless, 8 podcasts, which will be probably scattered around and played throughout the year, and hopefully you guys will enjoy those really incredible speakers. And thank you so much for the THU team for bringing them and for the incredible experience that it was to speak to them all over the map, as it is at THU, all over the map. All right, guys. Like I said, this is a really special podcast for me in terms of the Construct short and working with Kevin Margo and Darren Ross on this. I helped produce it, as did Darren, and this is something that was really kind of a celebration for us. Again, watch the short before you listen to this podcast. All right, thanks, guys.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
It is coming up on 5 years that I've been at Chaos Group.
Uh-huh. Wow. Congrats.
Thank you.
B5O.
And Construct is one of the first projects that I worked on here. So that means we've been working on Construct for 5 years,
five
Kevin.
5 long years.
Yeah. What do you think about that?
What are you really trying to say, Chris?
Well, a lot. Okay, so Construct's been going on for 5 years, but I don't think you even imagined all the things you would do with that project when you started it, or maybe you did.
No. I didn't even anticipate ever doing it. But then when, you guys, Lon and Chris, you started the Chaos Group office here, and then, you kind of approached me saying, hey, we liked what you did with Grounded and let us know how we can help you as a filmmaker. I had been kind of brainstorming this idea, this goal of figuring out how to do, real-time ray tracing in a virtual production context for a couple years before.
Why was that?
Well,
first of all, it's like about Grounded, because Grounded was one of the first things you guys did together.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. Darren, well.
Well, outside of our Blur work together.
Right.
It was
your first short film, wasn't it?
15 years, yeah. So, we worked professionally for many years before Grounded. We became friends, and Darren was expressing an interest in getting into live action filmmaking and acting. And at the same time, I was exploring DSLR cameras. The 5D Mark II had just come out back then. This was 2009.
What did that do? Why was that a landmark moment?
So, as someone that did not have connections or resources that live action filmmakers had, operating in the VFX and predominantly animation space up until that point, all of a sudden. Here comes this camera that is a tenth or a hundredth the cost of these Alexas or these Red cameras. And they were in a DSLR context, a small manual, like handheld context that I was familiar with using traditional photography about 15 years prior.
Right.
So an accessibly priced camera that could shoot HD footage at 24 frames per second.
Well, more specifically, what it was also doing is it had a big aperture compared to
full-frame sensor.
Full-frame sensor, big aperture.
Nice, sexy depth of field.
Right. So now you could get nice lenses on that thing.
You could be making imagery that, barring the subtleties of compression and all that stuff, looked pretty damn good and comparable to what you could get on an Alexa or a Red.
Right.
And that was my entry point into live-action filmmaking. As soon as I bought the camera and started tinkering with it, it spawned a whole bunch of ideas about what we could be doing with this, and at the same time, Darren is getting into this space as well, and Grounded was a very personal project for me. My father had passed away a few years before, and I'd been just reflecting on kind of what it means to be an artist professionally and then also personally. And, as amazing as like the job that I have has been, you are creating content for others. It's not your ideas. It doesn't stem, originally or just, from you initially. And as a fine artist trained in college, that was basically my mandate every single day was you're identifying challenges or problems or areas of interest that appeal to you, and figuring out where to explore within those areas, and problem solving these things yourself, so I kind of missed a bit of that. So Grounded was a rediscovery of personal expression, I guess you could say too. So that whole experience with Darren and a bunch of other friends too was kind of really eye opening for me. It just really reignited my passion and interest in creating, content, telling stories that were personal to me.
Right. And it was the first time you'd sort of used that technology. It's a kind of an interesting thing because it is sort of a bridge of like you looking at your professional career creatively as well as exploring new technology, right? Darren, what about you? I mean, for you, you were looking at a way to start getting into acting. What got you into the acting thing? Obviously, I know you're much as an animation director, right? So,
yeah, it was kind of a natural evolution. It wasn't like this like really big conscious decision of like, oh, I want to be an actor now.
Right.
I was getting more involved in acting in the motion capture that we were doing at the studio because I had an acting background.
Okay.
that I was doing and training in, and I also had a martial art background that I was doing and training in. Mm-hmm. So I was naturally evolving into doing it more at Blur in right. mocap, bringing and also bringing in actors and action actors and stunt people. And we had come off of the Batman Arkham, mm-hmm. Which was, you know, us using new technology with the facial capture, where Tim was like, hey, we're going to make you this mercenary and you're going to get tortured by Hugo Strange. And so, hey, what do you think? And I'm like, yeah, that's awesome.
Right.
And working with Kevin on that, it was all a great experience. We had shot what I thought was really cool was because a few of us had 5Ds and we had shot a live action previs of that whole game trailer. Right. So there was a section that was acting beats. And then there was a section that was stunts, and that was a great experience. And
you'll see fight choreographers do this a lot for films, where right. they go off and they basically shoot with, you know, 5Ds in a rec room or a gym.
Right.
Like they'll choreograph the whole sequence and present it to directors, and then they'll take that as kind of a blueprint when
yeah.
they go on
yeah,
set.
Yeah, basically these previs. Yeah,
exactly. Just with the live action exactly. Camera. And I'm trying to remember at that time. I think we had done it prior, like for like some Star Wars stuff. We'd done some acting and some action previs.
Right.
And so we always found the benefit of that, especially us as a group of guys that had our own 5Ds and we can just easily go in and shoot stuff real right. quick and bam and get it done. And so when Kevin had approached me about Grounded, I was like, well, yeah, that sounds great. And then he showed me he had shot previs for the short.
Right.
Which was awesome. And like the whole thing was like it was you and Barrett. Pretty much just you guys yep. doing it on your own. And I was like, dude, this is awesome. You have right. the whole thing already mapped out, great shots. I mean, like, it was all there. I mean, like, if and I don't know if you never released the probably that, you know, but like if you watched Kevin's previs and you watched the short, like it's pretty close.
Wow.
And that was amazing.
Well, it's really good to use that to plan things out, right?
Oh
yeah.
Tremendously.
Blur's taught us one thing. It's just try and anticipate as much as you can and be
for
prepared
sure.
for it.
Right.
And that just carried over into as we were producing and, you know, planning for Grounded as well.
But what's also interesting is you guys came from, you know, obviously you come from the Blur did not do live action at that time, right?
No.
And so Blur did a lot of things, or you were starting to do things like prevising things
yep.
or motion capturing, et cetera, yep. that are trying to get real live action performances into CG. Mm-hmm. So you're starting to already understand that.
Yeah.
And then for Grounded, you transitioned that and said, I'm actually going to make a full live action short here.
That was a great idea I just had.
Yeah.
Sorry, my brain just going off.
Update into your brain.
So, but anyway, it was, you know, it's basically a you know, trying to get that live action thing going, and then, which by the way, we should watch. You guys should watch Grounded, but I want to make sure we have enough time to talk mm-hmm. about Construct. There was something in the element of Grounded that inspired you into yeah. Construct.
So, you know, coming out of that experience with Grounded, you know, my first experience with live action filmmaking, you know, every medium has its perks and its drawbacks.
Sure.
Okay, so. With visual effects and animation, you can redo everything, like, you know, given the energy that you want to invest to a relatively, you know, modest degree. Okay.
Sure. You can move on a whole building.
Yeah. You can change animation, you can change cameras, yes. you can change lighting. Mm-hmm. I mean, it all takes time and energy, but mm-hmm. I mean, try and do that on a live action set. You're going back for reshoots and you're dropping like big money to, mm-hmm. to essentially revisit a scene or a shot within a scene.
Right.
So, you know, there's that. That's great for visual effects and animation. What I loved about live action was when you hit record and you're staring at what you're seeing through your viewfinder or on the monitor, it is what you're capturing and what you're getting and what you're walking off set with looks photoreal and it looks amazing, looks beautiful.
Right.
And while you're shooting, as a cinematographer while you're shooting it, you are able to see all these elements in play dynamically, and as a camera operator, as an actor, as a director, everybody is aware and privy to what everybody else is doing in the moment of that scene, of that take, of that performance.
Right.
And there's this tension of like spontaneity and like, you know, everything is on the verge of falling to pieces. Everybody just got to kind of keep it together and like strive for something of beauty, but it's like kind of that tension of like imperfection that I think is like the most beautiful thing about like live action, where everything is in play simultaneously and everything is influencing and responding to everything else.
Right. So you were what I was always heard you saying when you started concentrating is like, I want to do what I've been doing at Blur, but I want to do it much closer to how I did it on Grounded.
Yeah. So that the benefits that I got out of Grounded, shooting a live action film.
Right.
And then looking at a typical animation production pipeline where the person doing the camera operations is composing to grayscale viewport models. Right. And they're not able to see like the materials, the lighting, the environment, the atmosphere, the depth of field, the motion blur, all this stuff that at the back end of the process we're finally seeing months later.
Right.
And often the lighters and the compositors are having to reverse engineer good compositions because, like, you know, the front end of the pipeline, the previous artists weren't privy or aware to the full range of artistic elements that they could have at their command to compose a frame.
Right. So just because some people may not know this, but when you're looking at, when you're doing motion capture, you're usually using an extremely rudimentary view of whatever you're motion capturing, right?
Mm-hmm.
Video game or less.
Yes. Often less.
Yeah. Often less.
Much less, right?
Yeah. At least for our projects.
Right. But so it is very, very rough. And it doesn't look even close to what the final image is.
Yeah,
right?
We might not have the environments yet. We might even know exactly what the characters fully look like yet. You know, sometimes yes, sometimes no.
But not just that. I mean, just the fundamental way of it rendering the image.
Oh, yeah.
Is much, much lower.
And to build even on top of that further, like when you're on a live action set and you're working with your actors and your cinematographer and you're staging a scene, as it relates to an environment and to the lighting.
Yes.
And the cinematographer is like, you know, figuring out the 180, you guys are figuring out like which general direction you're going to shoot, knowing the time of the day and the lighting and, you know, what's cinematically going to work, not only just a character against an invisible empty void behind them, but how does their framing relate, you know, how does the camera framing relate to, you know, the character in the world?
Sure.
And, you know, typically, historically, that's not really been doable or achieve much in virtual.
It's the typical problem, right? Yeah. And you know this, Darren, because you've acted in motion capture. It's really hard to act while having to imagine everything else around you, right?
Well, I will say it's if you're not trained in that as an actor, it can be difficult.
Right.
There are actors who have no problem with that,
right?
And they will be able to imagine everything. And then there's some that, you know, they could be awesome actors, but they struggle with it because they just might not have been thrown in this kind of world that they have to imagine that, oh, and this is going on here and it's going to be this environment. You're going to see that character and whoa, wait, what?
And, you know, so I would say, yes, some actors are capable of doing that. And obviously you want to get a hold of those guys or girls and have them on in your production. But there are a ton of other talented performers that may need a little more assistance in visualizing like their context. And so it's basically about maximizing the chances for good performances.
But let's go back to your cinematography thing, because I think that's another important factor. Yeah. Often a lot of cinematography is kind of thrown out the window because it's just not in the shot when you're looking at it in a rough way, right? Mm-hmm. So you don't really consider lighting or environment that much because it's kind of like it's roughed in there and like, yeah, it's kind of like this. And you're like, you back of your mind, you're probably going, yeah, we'll fix that later. Mm-hmm. You know, you're not really like, no, I really want to compose this shot. You're like, I'll sort of compose it. You can't really sort of compose it, just compose it.
And that's where the benefits of like the virtual production, the animation pipeline can come into play, because if you're on a set, like to change lighting or change lenses is very time consuming and you're racking up dollars by the minute.
Right.
Now all of a sudden you can have like, theoretically you could have your production designer moving the props and set pieces around. You have the lighter adjusting lights at the same time the cinematographer is changing his lenses. This is all happening like within seconds.
But more specifically, the cinematographer was not always around during motion capture. You know what I mean? That's not available. And so now suddenly you're starting to think, what if the cinematographer was around during that time?
Yeah. And, you know, it's, you know, the more you can kind of create a working condition or a context that they're familiar with from mm-hmm. the live action space, like, you know, the more you're going to get out of them in a virtual space. Okay. So, so Ken's saying the Deadpool cinematographer. Okay. So at Blur, after Deadpool like was very successful, we started having Ken in like, you know, weekly to our reviews, and he would comment, you know, would sit in a screening room, okay, mm-hmm. in a dark room, and, you know, he would give feedback and thoughts about like, you know, if I was on set, I would do this, or I would frame it this way, or
I love that when it happens. Yeah.
Yeah. But he's sitting miles away from a scenario where he could actually be interfacing with the artists and, you know, the actors.
It's still I'll give this feedback and I'll see what happens tomorrow.
Right. But yeah. Why not get him into a space where he can be talking to somebody, you know, 10 foot away, and he could see his request happen seconds later.
No, you know? I know. Well, let's not jump too fast mm-hmm. about that, because I think I want to make sure we sort of understand your motivation here was like, is from Grounded into going to Construct. And some people may not know the progression of what that happened. But the first thing that you asked us was, I just want to render as fast as possible. Right?
Don't we all?
So don't we all? And so our thing was, we had several things had come out right at that time. One is, we had been working very hard to make the GPU render more than a preview editor or a preview renderer. We thought of it as final frame rendering. Mm-hmm. That's one thing. The next thing that happened is NVIDIA had come out at that time with the K6000s, which were the Kepler cards. And those were the first cards to have 12 gigs of video memory. At that time, that was unheard of. Nothing was like 6 was the most, I think, or something. Maybe 8. No, I think 6 was the most.
Which is not a lot. I mean, which before, is not a still lot. Wasn't
12
quite a lot.
But 12 was enough to say, if I'm smart, I can fit a lot on 12 gigs of memory.
Yep.
So we thought, okay, let's talk to NVIDIA and, you know, get our developers and let's start bridging this thing. And we also got together with Box, and Box decided to support the project mm-hmm. as well.
OptiTrack helped us out.
And OptiTrack mm-hmm. for, you know, later down when we started looking into motion capture. But just for like, let's render this short. Mm-hmm. We gave you, I think, 3 or 4 machines.
Mm-hmm. Three machines,
and I think 12 cards.
Yeah. Was it 12? 9 cards, I think. Maybe 12. Yeah. But, I was only able to fit 3 in because the PCI slots had some weird thing in the life before. Anyway,
but I think you loaned some to some people who were helping
you,
too.
Some of my friends, yep.
So that they could see it happening as well.
Yep. So we got all these cards. Mm-hmm. I had not, I think I might have tinkered with GPU rendering a little bit before then, but I knew of the potential like creative benefits. Mm-hmm. You can render damn fast, and you could hypothetically get into a situation where you could be lighting and relighting in real time.
Right.
And once that can happen, what else can you do in real time with this kind of, you know, progressive ray tracing, path tracing? Well, you can dump it into a motion capture context.
Right. But your render times went from like what would have been an hour down to like 5 minutes or less.
Yeah. So like, I mean, initial benchmarks was I had like whatever the latest i7 at the time was. Mm-hmm. And then 3 of those K6000s in my box. Mm-hmm. Well, one K6000 was giving me a 5x performance boost over the i7 core. So 3 of them, 15x performance over the i7 core. So
15 times faster.
Yep. Yep.
So a lot faster.
And that was just like rendering final frames and kind of like, you know, like, well, final frame render mode. When I switched over to like live RT mode, mm-hmm. where it was progressive rendering like concurrently, I was seeing like, I think 40x boost in terms of the real time like rendering aspect of things over what a CPU could do progressively, interactively.
Well, what you did is at that point you put out the teaser, right? At that point, right?
Yeah,
And so you rendered that all out of your one-bedroom apartment.
Yeah, 300-square-foot, nice little Venice bungalow.
Yeah.
We the first minute that we presented at NVIDIA's GTC conference in 2014.
Yeah. That was a pretty accelerated schedule to put out that little short.
Yeah, I think we –
About a minute and a half?
I think you guys – we started talking in like November, December of like 2013, and then we didn't like actually – hit the ground running until January, and then 2.5 months later, we're shown the first minute of the project.
Which is amazing, considering you put it all in, you did it all out of your apartment. Now, and that included motion capture, right? Mm-hmm. that included a lot of stuff. But you guys motion captured the whole short, I believe.
Yes.
Yeah, we did. I think it wound up being 3 or 4 weekends, 2 days each, so like 6 or 7 days of motion capture.
Right.
Those first 2 months as well.
Okay.
Where we had plotted out the whole project and captured everything we needed, and then we extracted 1 minute out of it that became the teaser that went online, and then the rest of it we slowly worked through over the following year and a half, almost 2 years.
Right. Well, there was a lot to think about, and there was a lot going on. But what was I'm saying this facetiously, but you were a little bit distracted by Elsa's cool new technology.
I know.
And the one thing you said, it was like, what if I could see this while motion capturing? What if I could ray trace while motion capturing? And I did not, honestly speaking, I did not understand why you would want to do that. It just didn't make any sense. But because we had at that time created the app SDK, which was this tool which enabled us to put V-Ray inside of any application, nearly any application, we were going to test it on, and it's like, can we put it inside of Motion Builder at the time? And we did. We put it there up to a point that you could operate, right, and test it.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Just like a Python script that you would launch, right, and it would fire up the window and go to town. You would just merge in a VR scene file and some materials onto your FBX imported characters, and you're off and running.
And that was the first time we were able to see it. I remember that moment. We were over at Rouge, right? And you were in the motion capture suit, and we were rendering you in live in real time, ray tracing you in real time.
Yeah, it was trippy.
At that time, it was trippy.
Especially when we had the mirror inside the environment. So I could see
your own reflection
in the environment.
You got to show off ray tracing. You got to get a mirror in there.
Yep. Yeah, it's like, that was like, whoa.
Right.
In all the years of mocap, I hadn't had that experience. That was...
It was pretty, cool. There were several things that, because, like I said, I hadn't thought of it. Like, why would you do that, right? It's just, I was naive, sorry. It was, when you did it, and I saw it, and at that time it was only on 3 cards, and it was grainy, and there were the old K6000s, but still, right? I mean, obviously, we mentioned it's been 5 years since we started this, but all of a sudden, I started imagining, it's like, oh, I get it now. Everything you were just saying, like, I want to do live action stuff and see as close to the final as possible. You want to bridge that. There's such a massive gap between pre-production motion capture to final frame. Mm-hmm. How long is sometimes months and months can go by between those two things? Mm-hmm. And just being able to say, I have a much closer idea of what it's going to look like the final in that way.
Just everything collapses into one moment.
That's the goal. And you can light it in real time. And then suddenly, you can bring the DP back on set. It's like, let's light this thing, right?
Yep.
And you can put in, big lights. You can have a whole light kit that you can involve right there.
Shoot virtual a bunch of HDRs of, live action lights, your Kino Flows, Fresnels, whatever. And then map those onto V-Ray lights and, have the same control with the white balance and intensity and outputs. And it's all physically based, so the inverse square thing, applies. You move the light farther away, it gets dimmer.
And you can have an HDR of a magic hour, and it'll last for hours and hours and hours.
That's true, which is an excellent point.
Yeah, no.
Golden hour all day long. Your window of, I only have 30 minutes is gone.
I remember when I was on Oblivion, Eric Barber was joking. He's like, magic hour on Oblivion, because it was in Iceland, and goes, it's like 5 hours.
Nice.
That's funny.
Because it's all just kind of like
hangs at that 5 o'clock.
But it was really kind of a beautiful idea, and I started to understand all the potential, right? You're reintroducing, based on your original thesis, right, bringing back all the live action, the goodies of live action cinematography into the CG environment, while still not destroying all the benefit of the CG, right?
Totally, yeah. Yep.
Because you can still move a building, and you can still change your lighting or change the time of day.
The flexibility.
Right.
Yeah.
And it was really, really cool. It was really cool. What was it? What was some of your thoughts going behind your mind when you saw that?
I look back, we shot all this video, and I curse and say, fuck, holy fuck, holy yeah. shit, quite a lot.
Quite a lot, yeah.
So I'm going to do an outtake edit of like 2 minutes of me just like cursing up a storm.
Well, you were, yeah, because you were excited.
Well, yeah, it, with enthusiasm. Yeah. Well, actually, there's two. There's the cursing out of desperation when things crash, and then the cursing out of joy and excitement
you're
out
dealing
of, like,
with, like,
when you're doing amazing.
Completely fuck. Yeah. Software that is developed from nothing and all done in Python scripts. But yeah, it's but when it worked, it was amazing.
Yeah, no, it was that day was like, you know, when you have an idea and you kind of strive and struggle to pull it together and like you want to see it come together and manifest itself.
Right.
And like when you work towards that goal, like to arrive at the time and the moment when that is happening in front of you, it's like you realize like, you know, months and months of work and like, you know, years of desire of seeing something like this come together, like it's very powerful, you know, and rewarding to kind of, you know, see,
What were some of your thoughts, Darren, when you saw that stuff? Obviously, seeing yourself in the mirror was kind of weird.
Oh, yeah. It was, as I was saying, I was like tripped out because we get so used to, again, going back to the training of an actor is you enjoy actually the improvisation of mocap. You enjoy that, okay, well, we're not locked down as much, and it's okay that we have to imagine it all. There's fun in that. But, boy, is it great when you don't have to imagine as much and you can actually see where you are.
Now, to be clear, you technically, the way that we did it, you don't see yourself immediately, but you can see the take that you just did and say, ah, now I get what it's looking like.
Yeah.
And then it becomes easier, right?
Yeah, that's usually way more down the line.
Your second take is going to be way better.
I mean, you can, I think, it's just flexibility. You could play more. We could see how, because especially we had really measured out in the volume where everything was. So we really could be not only act to the space and go, all right, well, the door's here, the stairs are here, you're going to walk around the corner and turn, but you could see it better.
Right.
And not in this, like, as you said earlier, like really rough, gray shaded, like blah. It's like, oh wow, that's pretty cool. That's really what it's going to look like.
Right.
How does that inform us in each take and pushing this forward and making it better?
Right. Well, here's what I want to do. I want to keep talking about some of this technology you've done along the way, but at some point I want to start talking about the actual short because I know it's, you know, by the time we put this podcast out, it'll be out on the internet and people can talk about it and want to know more. But we continue to do this stuff. Like the first thing I mentioned is like it was only three GPUs. They were older GPUs and we had a smaller window and it's fairly noisy when we were capturing, but it was still mind-blowing that you could see ray tracing happening at that level. Mm-hmm. So we wanted a lot more GPUs, right? So we had a VCA, but the VCA's big and clunky and loud, and they're hard to move. We couldn't get straight Linux on or straight Windows on it to boot Motion Builder. Big problems, et cetera, et cetera. So that's when we got the cloud guys involved, Boris and those guys.
Yeah. So, like you said, like, came off of the mocap stage with three cards. I was like, all right, cool. This is pretty cool. But how do we scale up? at that time, NVIDIA was seeing what we were doing. It was very excited and thrilled. So they invited us to use their they got their cloud farm up in Santa Clara.
Yeah, their cluster.
Yeah.
Yep.
So what's up there? There was
16
VCAs, 150 of these GPUs.
There was more than that.
Like scientists are running physics simulations and neurologists are
analyzing
brains.
It's a big GPU computational machine that was working at that time.
And then you guys were firing up like the whole cloud division, right?
Well, we looked for downtime on the VCA and got borrowed time from them. But what our idea was, we were trying to figure out a way that we could use the resources for rendering on send that data to another machine that's just doing V-Ray, right? So you have your motion capture box that's doing the capturing. The way we used to do it was motion capture doing boxing. It's also doing the rendering because it's all the data still there. You know, it's pretty straightforward.
Yep.
But then we thought, it's like, what if we did that and then we use what we, you know, we call our distributed rendering system that takes whatever the data is coming in and then sends it to another machine to do the actual rendering and gives you the image back. Well, we scale that up even more.
And that other machine was 500 miles
500
north.
Miles away.
Yeah. Which is why it's still amazing. Yeah. When I think back to when we were doing that, it's incredible.
So it's at 500 miles away, and then we did a very special version of distributed rendering that enabled us to basically split up the workload of that image amongst, was it 4 or 8 VCAs?
I think it was 8.
4.
There were 4 with 8 cards. We used 32 GPUs.
We used 32 cards.
Day.
So yeah. 4 VCAs were working mm-hmm. on this thing. So 32 video cards and next generation video cards compared to the K6000. Mm-hmm. So we had next generation video cards rendering at 32 cards as opposed to 3 cards. Mm-hmm. Big, big difference in scale. What was even more amazing is that Boris said, instead of trying to bring the image back to the computer, because that's actually a lot of data to bring back, he just turned one of the machines into a web server and made it basically a web page that's the viewport.
Like a YouTube stream, basically.
Like a YouTube stream. Yeah. The live YouTube stream.
So then back here in Culver City when we were testing this out, the virtual camera basically was an extended monitor of the desktop, and it was basically just a web browser, full screen.
You just typed
in
the IP
address.
Yeah.
And it was more or less streaming that that rendering that was going on 500 miles north.
And anyone in the world could actually see that at any point in time, as long as they had the IP address and the password and all the other stuff.
Like Boris had been testing out from like the plane, across the Atlantic or something.
They were motion capturing. We were doing testing it on Bulgaria while they were doing the stuff here in Santa Clara. So, but the quality jump was huge, big quality jump, right?
Yeah. No, I think we were doing HD resolution, mm-hmm. And then we increased the samples per pixel, so it wasn't as grainy, right?
It was significantly less grainy.
So it was like the previous experiment that we were doing with just like the local box at Rouge, the mocap stage. You know, 3 cards, like the Polaroid mode. So basically, like you would get interactivity, and it was really grainy, and you could just like hit freeze, and then the progressive path tracing would catch up and refine the image to something that looks.
So after about a second or so, we do it.
Yeah,
but you need the rendering to happen 1/24th of a second.
Yep.
And with this one, you didn't feel you needed it, right?
No. Yeah. I mean, you were getting stuff that looked pretty creamy to me. There were a few fireflies, depending on the angle or whatever. But yeah, it looked a hell of a lot better than the previous experiments we had.
Massive speed.
Oh yeah. But interestingly enough, like we encountered some other little bottlenecks, like the whole public internet infrastructure thing with trying to do things like in real time,
because we're going through the public internet to do this, right? So this process of sending data from Culver City, actually right here in this office, to Santa Clara, which is up in the Bay Area. That's still a 500 mile distance, but you're going through public lines to do that, right?
But and then when we did the initial trial run before we recorded the video, it was 1 or 2 a.m. in the morning, and everybody was asleep, so generally less network traffic. So we were getting some pretty good. I mean, there was a little bit of latency, but it was pretty responsive.
Right.
And then the next day at Netflix hour 9 p.m. when we're recording the video, you notice the latency spikes up a little bit.
Up, yeah.
And then we started doing the math. It's your home base is in Sofia, Bulgaria, right?
Yep.
And then if you're using the cluster in Santa Clara in California, you actually start visibly witnessing speed of light impacts on your latency.
Yeah.
And it's insane to think that I think when you do the math, it's like a frame a second or something or almost a frame a second.
No, it's more than that. It's half a second at least.
No, with the speed of light. And I think it was
a frame a second. No, back and forth. Think about it. You're going to go around the whole world.
186,000 miles. 24. Something like
speed of light is not fast enough.
Yeah, exactly. to do what we need to do. Yeah.
Right.
So which then spawns the whole because then people start to talk about
wormholes. Wormholes. That's the next technology you guys developing, right?
It makes sense now it's something when it comes this began a huge conversation. We're all thinking about everything about cloud now because cloud now is all about. How close am I to a data center, right? Because the data center, that's your latency is how close you are to a data center.
And that's what they do on Wall Street, right? All the Wall Street firms try and get their computers as close as possible to the floor.
Some of them have special fiber optic lines where they try to make them as straight as possible.
Yep.
So no turns on that fiber.
Every little edge.
Yeah.
to get the information faster than others.
But they, so it's really interesting that all of a sudden you're making a short film and you're thinking about how the speed of light is impacting your short film.
Yeah.
That's what mad geniuses do.
We're wrangling live photons and trying to simulate, you know, photons and virtually as well.
But so anyway, so that was sort of, you know, what happened. But at that point now, you were starting to use this technology to compose shots. You were saying, all right, let's start composing shots. Let's start doing things. And there's a large fight sequence that happens in your short. And you rethought the way of how that's going to be in a very interesting way. So talk a little bit about the fighting sequence and how you decided to shoot that.
So, and Darren, chime in. the way typically we shoot, or the way we typically produce content, is we'll shoot mocap. We'll stage it as best we can. We'll shoot it, the performances, as long as we can. But very quickly, we'll get it into previs and layout and be establishing cameras with certain frame ranges, and we wind up committing to the two subsets of those performances pretty quickly and early on in the process, right?
Yes.
So from, yeah.
Well, no, yeah, that's all correct. But but what we wanted to do with this, Kevin already had the forethought of like, yes, we're obviously going to pick a line of action to stick to show points of the fight, beats, but let's try to make this work as much as possibly independent of the camera, because there are things I'm thinking of down the line that would be nice if we can walk around this and like all the, you know, this VR aspect of it. Like, he was already thinking that way.
Mm-hmm. So, but also from an efficiency standpoint, like if we could just generally agree on the line of action and the staging and focus on getting longer extended performances.
Right.
That means that a virtual cinematographer could go in and shoot dozens of cameras to that take.
Again, that's a part of the efficiency of your CG. So you're trying to leverage both the efficiencies of both sides, right?
Yep.
If you had to shoot that over and over and over again with those stunt guys for days and days and days, I mean, God, that's so expensive.
Yeah, right? Well, not only is it expensive, but it's just – it's way more challenging when you're in real live action – especially in stunt fight choreography, you have to have the camera angles figured out, because you just can't shoot from every angle, because it's going to look like a miss, you know. Right. So the impacts, you have to cheat and sell per camera angle.
Right.
So with motion capture and animation, we don't have to do that. We have to worry about that. You know, we have, you know, the characters basically are making what is full contact in a CG world, you know. Right. So it can look good at every angle, because we're not having to cheat to a camera. We don't have to fake hits.
So that's how you do it is you fake hits in camera, right? And just add a sound effect and then bam.
Yeah. Well, yes, for some, and for some that there is still full contact. I mean, you know, when you've got really talented martial artists that are padded up in certain ways and not padded up in certain ways, they will make contact still.
Right.
That also will look good at every angle, but there is still a lot you have to cheat. So, so they, you know, it's finding a balance in the real world. But even with that all said, even if you are doing full contact stunts, there's only so many takes you're going to be doing that for.
Right.
You know, so, I mean, you can only take so much abuse.
And when a lot of times when we're doing those stunts, like, there's a lot of rigging involved. So you do have to commit to, okay, we're going to, you know, pause the performance in action here and capture this one moment where this guy, like, you know, heroically, like, is able to, like, jump back up onto his feet.
Right.
You know, so there's, like, rigging involved.
Well, let's talk about these stunt guys real quick, because that was another real amazing coup by you guys. This was a top-notch stunt crew that you guys got here, right?
Yeah, that comes out of the years of relationship building that I had built with martial artists and the stunt community. And so when Kevin approached me about doing the project, you know, he said first of all, with Kevin being a good friend and what a great experience we had on Grounded, I had told him, I'm like, bro, whatever you're doing, man, I'm in. I'm game. And so when he approached me with contract, he's like, hey, I'm gonna do this thing. You wanna do this, and there's gonna be some action in it. And I'm like, yeah, absolutely. He's like, you know, you think some of the stunt guys, you know, that are friends with would jump in. I'm like, absolutely. I know they definitely will. Okay. And so I talked to a few different guys, and Phil who was Phil's a very close friend, Philip Silvera. He was like, "Yeah, man, let's do this," you know. And he brought A-list guys that we had been working with as well from prior projects that also were all like, "Yeah, man, let's do this." And
They were, you know, top notch. They like those stunt previews that I mentioned. They, you know, we would have like we would go in on a weekend with 2 days in there. Like on a Saturday would be rehearsal, and they would shoot everything with the 5Ds, and then like they would try and go home that night and edit together a quick little previs of the whole sequence played out. So then the next morning on a Sunday when we came into to actually shoot the sequence with motion capture markers and all our mocap TDs, like we had an edit that we were looking at, and we really understood what we were going to be shooting that
day.
You
knew every sequence of how it was going
to go. Yeah, and that's something that I've been always heavily involved with stunt teams at the studio is designing action with them, choreographing with them, shooting with them as well, because it's just a big part of what I got involved with that I love to do. Mm-hmm. So I'm also one of those guys there with a camera helping shoot A and B angles of all these stunts with the guys.
Right.
You know, so, and then all that footage, yes, we go over and then we edit it together and we have something that's a, you know, not every angle may be the right angle, but at least we've got enough of an idea of where the line of action, the best line of action may be for this stuff to kind of go, all right, this is a linear progression of what these fight beats are that make pretty good sense from these angles.
Right. Right.
And I mean, one of the many great things about Darren is it not only animation supervisor and like an actor, so, you know, feeds into his animation, you know, capabilities, but he's also, you know, he thinks cinematically and editorially as well. So he's done a whole lot of, you know, layout and previs at the studio. And then, you know, that just extends to when he's shooting all this, you know, stunt previs as well. Like he can really think that way and set the scene and the performance up for success later on.
Yeah, because the fight sequence is not simple. Yeah.
No, it's well, no.
The construct
is a lot of stuff going on.
No, it's not.
There's a lot of stuff going on in that.
Yeah, and I think that the
multiple people, multiple angles, multiple tools and props.
Right.
And,
which, again, is our own doing.
Like right.
I tried to keep it as simple
and then
as possible.
You have a character with four arms.
I would say that we definitely created a hell of a lot of work for ourselves.
Right.
You know, it's great to have friends to jump in, but then the more guys you have that are fighting, the more work you have to do.
Right.
Especially the other aspect of this that creates a lot of work and is challenging is that, yeah, we try to do as long of a sequence of fight beats as we can, but we have to break stuff up. It's for multiple reasons. It's not only from a performance standpoint with the team, it's where we only have so much room in the volume, the motion capture volume, so we can only go so far in distance in the fight, and then we have to reset because we just ran out of space and we're out of the volume.
Right.
So that takes a lot of planning on our end to go, okay, all right, we're gonna go, you know, we're gonna take the fight beats up to here, reset. The next fight beats up to here, reset. And then there's things like Kevin was mentioning before where there's what we'll call a specialty move that we may isolate because that move might need a different performer for that moment, or it needs the rigging team, the stunt riggers to bring in, you know, somebody's in a harness now we've got to fly them up, or it's a rig that helps them do a particular type of flip.
Right.
That's higher in the air, things like that. So
and, you know, one of the additional efficiencies that we really tried to capture, just knowing the limited resource constraints to, you know, do all the animation we would have, was, you know, we would stitch all these individual moves together. We basically create like the longest uninterrupted performance stitching all these different little, you know, insert stunt gags together. Mm-hmm. So we would have like 30, 40, 50 second long performances independent of a camera that then, and then we would animate, do a like a rough first pass animation on everything too. Not just like stitch the clips together, but, you know, have a good solid first pass go at the entire animated sequence independent of camera. And then I would go back in and then I would shoot like my dozens of cameras to that 40 second clip. And 9 out of 10 times, the first pass animation worked completely fine for the camera context.
Yeah.
So, you know, then only 1 out of 10 actually needed to be carried to second and third pass animation. Now, granted, I mean, it was robots, so like there wasn't, you know, like a lot of stuff that you would be doing in second and third pass animation typically, like, didn't really need to happen.
Right.
You know, some eye darts, making sure like finger contacts were good between characters. But that was also another thing that was able to, you know, to get us through.
You didn't have to do like, shot modeling or anything like that. Yeah.
That's where most of the work really comes in when it's that kind of fight choreography, especially with multiple characters, is if we're doing whether it's hand-to-hand combat or weapons, the contact that is happening between the performers is where all the work has to be put in. It's never a one-to-one, you know, and you know, it's great to have the awesome martial artists and stunt people we have that give us that base performance, but that's like the very beginning, because we've got to do a lot of work to get back to matching the performance.
Right.
Because there's different heights. Not everybody is going to match what the final size of the character is. And you know, stunt people are all different heights and sizes and stuff. And so getting all that back on per take, per section of fight beats is where a lot of that goes.
Right.
Work goes back into, okay, well, now the contacts look correct. Oh, and now we've got to blend across the different takes to get it all being one cohesive section of a fight. Yeah. That's where a lot of work goes back.
I want to get back to the height thing, because I think this is something else that was really good that you did on the show. You did pay attention to height when it came to the kid, right?
Yep.
So you had a child motion capture performers, because a lot of times some people try to get an adult to play a child. It
doesn't work. Different gates, different, like, you know, the way they carry. Yeah, exactly. And again, like, I mean,
who was the Logan?
Logan, yeah. Kishi, played Polly, the son.
Polly, yeah.
But actually what was cool is we also had a stunt double for Logan, which was pretty cool, which was an actual stunt coordinator named Mark Vanzolo.
Uh-huh.
Actually,
Liam Neeson's stunt double, right?
Yeah, he's Liam Neeson's stunt double. He's a stunt coordinator, second unit director. He's done a lot of
Liam Neeson's
films. Yeah, his son. He brought his son in, and it actually was kind of cool. His son got to be the stunt double for Logan.
Yep.
Right.
And that was exciting for him, because he hadn't had his son do something like that.
Right.
So Mark Vanzolo's son did that, which was really cool.
And you know, it's, and yeah, like anything you can do, like, you know, again, if
Mark also played
the foreman.
Yeah.
Oh,
so he actually performed robot with his son, which was like really exciting for all of us.
Oh, right, because he was holding him by the arm and all that stuff.
He comes in, he whacks his arm and all that, and he hits him and knocks him. So he's actually like
hitting his own dad.
He's hitting his own kid. He's hitting his own kid.
Yeah, that's awesome.
So sorry, I'm going to cut you over there.
No, that's great to know that these are things that people want to know. Yeah, that's awesome. I mean, it was a really – and that's the other thing. It's actually not one fight sequence. It's two fight sequences.
Yeah, one's like kind of – I don't know, physical, and the second one is, I think, personal. You know, it's like they operate at different levels. You know, like he's fighting for his own safety, and then like the family's safety gets involved, and then it steps up a notch, and the stakes are higher. And then that's where it's, you know, the Paul, Bill was the name of the main robot in the short film. His name has since evolved, but against the foreman.
And we really didn't hold back, you know, like – because we had limited resources, it probably would have been smarter to hold back a little bit. But there wasn't this, oh, well, you know, we can only do so much, so let's not go crazy here.
But I think you found a lot of savings along the way, because you had that right mentality, right? Like, for example, you said, I'm not going to shoot this forever and ever with the stunt guys and figure out everything. I'm going to take what I can, take the best performance I can, and I'll figure out some of the stuff I can do later. Like, take advantage of post-production where post-production is advantageous.
Yep.
Right? And then take advantage of live action where live action is advantageous. And you get to compose it. I mean, it made a big difference. Definitely a big difference. So one of the big things, because we're going to run too long if we go too far. One of the things I want to talk about is the fact that obviously, you know, it's taken many, many years, because there was a lot of these other things, including some of the stuff you did in VR. We did a VR version of this, which I can talk about a little bit later. But it's taken 5 years to get to where it's all of a sudden you feel that you're ready to put it out there. And that 5 years has not necessarily been because the rendering took too long or whatever. There's a lot of other factors that have been involved, right?
Yeah.
And I can remember seeing an early version of the final thing several years ago, right?
Yep.
And it's still pretty close to that. This story that is Construct is a very unusual story. It's complicated. And that's, I think, what I like so much about it, because you see a lot of like, I'm going to make an action movie with robots or whatever. And people have that idea. And they really just think about how things look. Mm-hmm. You've got something else going on that's very strange. There's things I've thought about that like...
Hard hats on the robots.
Hard hats on the robot. It's a robot drinking coffee.
Yep.
That's where does his mouth go, right? Mm-hmm. The robot has a kid. How's the kid work? The wife needs glasses. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot of interesting, weird things happening here. And some of it you don't think about till later, right, which is kind of interesting. You don't go like, that's stupid. Why does the robot need glasses? You don't even think about it. It's just like, it just seems, the robots seem so human, probably for a reason, that you get very emotionally invested into it. And I still watch it. I don't know about you, Darren, but when I watched the end, and by now everyone who is watching this should see the short. And if you haven't, pause now, watch the short, and then come back. But at the end, when you see Polly holding that briefcase, just like after the fight, it's like I still get emotional when I see that.
Yeah.
And I still remember us acting that moment out, and even when
I was there,
and you were there for that, day, right? And it's funny, every time I watch it, because the thing is that happens for me, because of working on it after the acting part, and doing animation on this stuff, and then all the other work, I will forget that it's me, right? So because you disconnect and then I go into animation mode and as a team that I'm animating and I'm supervising animators and we're just doing it and you're forgetting who's who. But when I watch it, and that is one of those moments that when I hear Logan's voice, mm-hmm. it takes me right back to that moment that we acted it and how real it felt.
Yeah.
Because Logan's a good actor. And
he's a very good actor.
You know, we working with Kevin's great because he really wants to give us the space to find these moments, you know? Yeah. And it may seem like, oh, it's just a robot thing. And it's like really like, but you know, we really wanted to make these relationships feel as believable as we could.
But Darren, think about this, because I don't understand how it happened, but it happened emotionally to me, right? And I'm still trying to figure this out, right? I study my digital human stuff with WikiHuman. I'm constantly thinking about micro expressions on faces and how they affect emotion. This is a blank piece of metal with a slit for a mouth that doesn't move and two eyes that just dart around and that's it. And yet somehow, and I think it's probably because of a really good motion capture, by the way, because I, you know, obviously you have very good motion capture talent, you know, the guys who run some motion capture, what's his name? I'm sorry.
Anthony.
Anthony does a really good job on this stuff. Plus obviously very good animators, but also it looks photo real. Like it looks really real. And the camera motion, you even had people comment on the fact, like, what did you shoot that on? They couldn't believe that it was not fully CG.
A lot of people thought the backgrounds of the environments were plates. And they were just, you know, digitally inserting, you know, VFX
robots. I've had filmmakers say that exact thing.
Right. And so I don't
ask that exact thing.
You can feel the emotion out of this character that's a piece of metal. And it's not just in the cartoony, you know, way. It's something very physical about it.
Yeah. I mean, I could – I'm interested in exploring a sense of, like, rawness. You know, it's like – so, you know, what are your associations with visual effects and CG? Huge high budget features, stage lit, you know, high, like super expensive production costs everywhere. Okay, well, how do you like extract the essence of what, you know, CG can do is create like virtual worlds. But then how do you like, you know, find like this like rawness to it? And it's like, well, it's almost like you try and treat everything like you would on an independent feature. Okay, you're running gunning it.
Yeah.
You don't have time for all these like elaborate lighting setups. So you're stuck working with natural light. And you're hurried, so you can't set up cameras and dollies and everything. You're shooting thing on the shoulder a lot. So all these things that I think bring a sense of like kind of like, I don't know,
like earnest honesty and mm-hmm. kind of, you know, like realness to the equation and this sense of struggle in the process. Like I think, and then paired with the performances, like I'm very interested in just trying to do as much as we can to just let the underlying performance carry through the digital character, you know, quirks and imperfections and all. And then paired with like, I mean, and then of course, like we had the opportunity because of the robots to avoid that uncanny valley thing.
Right.
And man, so much can just be told with the eyes, you know, and the VO.
Absolutely. But I
and
think
the body language,
there's so much, sorry, I'm getting back to this because going back to Grounded, obviously that's a short film that you shot, right? And mm-hmm. you took advantage of what you could with the camera by doing some beautiful, you know, shallow depth of field, et cetera. But you dealt with a lot of existing lighting and other things, right? Mm-hmm. You did the same thing on Construct, even though you could have done whatever. You could have lit this thing like Lord of the Rings, right? And it would have looked overproduced.
Right.
Yeah.
You know
what I mean?
Yeah. It would have taken me a whole lot more time to make it look overproduced.
Right, right. So your lighting was very simple.
Exactly.
Right?
I mean, it was efficiency. It was like, you know, it's like everything that makes an independent feature cheap, I basically like ran with and ran into.
Right.
You know? So I'm like, okay, I can't do these elaborate setups because I'm going to be sitting in front of my computer spending half a day or a day lighting this shot instead of just embracing the natural beauty of an HDRI that was captured and just composing to that. So then the question is, okay, well, how do you apply artistic elements and like how do you design a frame if you aren't designing lighting? Well, then what are your options at that point? Well, it's like depth of field, it's color, it's taking advantage of like the geometry of the scene, like all these mm-hmm. verticals and horizontals that like that construction site gives you, to find other areas to apply a sensibility to create unique or dynamic compositions that don't involve the more time-consuming lighting aspects of things.
Mm-hmm. In contrast, I think, was something that you always had in mind, too. Like, I remember Kevin going, like, we are intentionally going to have this structure only at its, like, wooden frame point.
Because
mm-hmm. I remember we talked about metals and stuff. And you're like, nah, I don't really want much metals in there. I want them to be the metallic thing inside this wooden structure. You know, there's some cement.
Well, so the contrast of the metal and wood.
Yeah, there's a shovel, but that's like properties. The only other like metal.
Right.
You know, which you know, he had all that in mind too, which was really cool.
And it's also a world that the viewers are very familiar with. So, you know, they're comfortable with it.
More relatable.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, okay, go ahead.
Sorry. I also wanted to just stepping back to the story and stuff, which was really cool. When Kevin was like, because he had some other short film ideas he was playing with at that time, mm-hmm. and we were gonna maybe start doing some tests for, and mm-hmm. then he was like, "This technology I want to try and push. I want to work on making." And it was this technology, and he's like, "So I'm gonna make a short. I'm gonna write a short that's gonna drive this."
Right.
That are actually going to drive each other. Technology is going to drive the story is going to drive the technology. And I was like, right on, bro.
Okay.
And then boom, he had written this story. And I was like, dude, that's like, and just jumped in.
Yeah. I mean, that might sound odd or a different approach, but in reality, you know, every creative endeavor that's undertaken operates within certain process or technological constraints.
Right.
And people have to problem solve their way through those constraints.
But I think I don't want to diminish it to that in the sense that I don't think your short is not a demo for the technology.
Because
the short was being developed and the technology was developed at the same time. As you were thinking about the story, the technology was taking advantage of, like, what can we do to do what your vision is, and vice versa. As we started to introduce, like, okay, now we got real-time ray tracing, it's like, what if I made a focus puller? What if I did this? What if I did that? So all of that, you were thinking about it on the fly, you know?
Yeah, and the types of stories that I want to tell and the way I want to tell them and create them are within a certain, like, a set of operating conditions or a workflow that I'm also driving towards.
Right.
You know, so it's like, I can't divorce the story and the way I create the story, you know, with the process.
Right.
It all needs to be interwoven.
Yeah, absolutely.
I keep referencing Steven Soderbergh as a prime example for this type of filmmaking.
Right.
He is one of the most prolific you know, directors, well, producers, directors, cinematographers, editors in the industry. Mm-hmm. He shot the show The Nick on mm-hmm. Cinemax a few years ago. He did two seasons. It was with Clive Owens. It was a period piece in New York in the 1900s. And, you know, I watched it. And I was like, there's something really fascinating about the end result here. So I did a whole lot of investigation research, and he's shooting this stuff. I mean, so he's producing it, he's directing it, he's lighting it, he's shooting it himself, he's editing the footage that he just shot hours before on the van ride back to the hotel. And the next morning, instead of dailies, they're looking at a first cut of the whole thing. He's basically shooting this stuff for half the price that other 1 hour, you know, episodic television shows are producing this stuff. Mm. And, you know, he's embraced technology to tell stories in a way that is comfortable and resonates with him.
Right.
You know, and that's basically what I'm interested in doing on the virtual end of things, in virtual production. How can we create a context that we can operate and create content in a similar manner, in an organic, fluid manner, to what Soderbergh does in a live action setting?
That's perfect. Yeah. That's great. Absolutely. So some of the other things that are going on and is the fact that, obviously, like I said, I saw early versions of this short that could have been released a couple of years ago. But you're looking at this story as something much bigger than that, right?
Yes. I set out with this story and investing. We all did a lot of energy into developing the short. And mm-hmm. you start to really think about what it could become and turn into. Mm-hmm. While I was working on the short, I started the gestate feature film ideas.
Right.
So, you know, it took us about 18 months to 2 years to actually produce the 12-minute short film.
Right.
I slept a few months, recovered, and then started to brainstorm a lot about what a feature idea could be. So right. I spent the summer putting together a feature pitch. Mm-hmm. Then developing it with my manager, and then we wound up taking it to town, mm-hmm. to the industry, to find creative partners that are embedded in Hollywood to help take this to the next step. Mm-hmm. Found a great producer, Brian Kavanaugh Jones, and his company Automatic, and he helped find development financing. Mm-hmm. And that led to getting a writer, Marcos Gabriel. Mm-hmm. And a year later, three drafts of the script. We all have a draft of the script that we really like. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's kind of led us up until this point. You know?
Right.
And the next steps are sharing it with the world, generating more interest and intrigue, and trying to attract, you know, more talent and potentially more financing to carry this over the finish line and actually get this project made.
Right. And you're no stranger to videos going out on the internet, and then suddenly the whole community decides that they want to make a movie.
Yeah,
well, you know, happening virally.
Well, yeah, when this Mr. Ed Poulnay. Ed
yes. Poulnay. Yes.
Ed Poulnay.
Sorry.
Yes. Yeah. So yeah. So that was something you were involved with, right? So you worked on
the Deadpool test.
The Deadpool test. The early, the one that came out. God, must have been eight years ago.
We made that in 2010 or 11.
Seven years ago.
And by the way, when you watch the Deadpool test footage, Deadpool drops into a car and he fights four thugs. Mm-hmm. And if you look closely, they're twins, quadruplets of Mr. Darren Ross here.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Agent Smith style, yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, again, this was kind of something we're producing on limited budget from Fox at the studio. And you know, we had to look at the resources we had. And Darren happened to be
from the
Batman Arkham City trailer,
right.
our latest and greatest attempt at photorealistic
head.
Yeah.
So he became the thugs.
Right.
So in 2010, 2011, Fox didn't buy it at the time. And I think it was good.
No one would ever make a live superhero movie that's R-rated.
Exactly. But, and honestly, I don't think at the time, like it wasn't the right time because it wound up sitting on a shelf for 4 years and then somehow it got leaked.
Yep.
And 4 years later,
Tim swears he doesn't know where that leak comes from.
Also, I think because of PG-13, you know, the broad audience, and then films like Watchmen came out, which was a good film, but didn't make money as a rated R.
But 4 years later, Marvel films, people acclimate to the culture and then are ready to poke fun at it.
Absolutely,
yes.
Absolutely. It was So it wasn't necessarily the right time for when it came out, but it was the right time when it leaked.
Exactly. Yes, it was a blessing in disguise.
But that's become a thing now. It's a big thing now to sort of have videos go on the internet to the whole world, because you can reach a much bigger audience through Vimeo than you can through a film festival circuit, right? Mm-hmm. You release it out there, and then everyone goes, "Oh my God, I want to see a movie of that." And then that's when you start getting the Waterball tour. I had the same conversation with Rory Robinson about mm-hmm. Leviathan.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. The same conversation with what's his name?
Dan Levy.
David Levy.
Yeah, David Levy.
And then who was the other guy I'm thinking of? Director of Maze Runner.
Wes Ball.
Yeah. Wes did the same thing, right?
So it's like, you know how they say social media is an amplifier of all these bad ideas? Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, social media is an amplifier.
It's just an amplifier.
of cool little short films, too.
Right, right.
It definitely helps get in front of the right eyeballs, when the rest of the internet is intrigued by it and enthusiastic about it. It's going to make it more appealing or, comforting for executives who are maybe risk adverse this idea.
See, because the problem is you have executives and they think they know what the crowd may want. Or at least they have the best guess of what's a safe bet, mm-hmm. right? But if they're like, that's not safe, I like the idea, but I can't risk it. But suddenly if they say, oh, look, we already have an audience of, 8 million people who have seen this video in 24 hours.
There's already an audience there.
Yeah, that helps my risk, they're right there, right?
Yep.
So I think it's really cool. So that's the right thing to do, I think. You're right. It's just see that and then test it out there with the audience. Say, what do you guys think, and I think that you've done some amazing work on it. Let's go. We're just over an hour, but mm-hmm. I want to touch real quick on where you started to think about VR in this process and why that started to become something that you were interested in.
The reason why I'm doing, CG visual effects is because of Myst and Riven, two video games in the late 90s.
Yeah.
The older I get, and the more people I talk to, the less people remember it because they're all younger than me and they haven't been born yet.
Yeah.
But at the time, these were two games that they were the first games to really embrace 3D model, 3D software to generate high quality images. I mean, there was Doom, but it was a super low res, but these were kind of whatever the latest, greatest, version of Maya or Alias, whatever, Power Animator, whatever could be generated at the time. They created these immersive 3D worlds that you could drop into and walk around. It was very experiential and immersive, and you could explore and mm-hmm. take your time and your own pace, and you felt involved and immersed in the world.
Right.
I played those games. I was a fine arts major before that. I was painting and drawing, and I realized that these games are achieving something that I was creatively striving for in my landscape painting and mm-hmm. my figure drawing. It's like that sense of being present and immersed in the world and passively trying to capture and embrace what's in front of me and translate that into an experience or an image.
Right.
So that I'm like, how do I make this kind of imagery? And I learned 3D because of that, and then that kind of sent me down the way. So why I referenced Myst and Riven was because it's this sense of an immersive world. And then right. when VR started to pop up and get really hot, 4 or 5 years ago, I started to get intrigued. Mm-hmm. I felt like things were coming full circle. Now I embrace this technology and this medium that facilitated me to create as immersive an experience as I could. And sure. now here's another new medium using all the tools that I already know that can take it even a step further.
Yeah.
So that's kind of set the interest in VR to begin with. So here I am making Construct, and I'm also using GPU rendering, and you can render big frames really quickly. And you guys had implemented the stereo cube maps and V-Ray and everything. So immediately I jumped on that, and I was rendering these 20K resolution images and checking it out in the Samsung Gear VR, and was getting really excited. I kept exploring this, and eventually it led to striking up a relationship with Starbreeze, who acquired Nozone, who's making the Presence plugin
yep.
That for V-Ray.
Yep.
And, so one of my reservations with VR was quality. Yes. So, you know, it's not like you look at the most amazing high-end AAA games, you know, that are running on like your desktop PCs. Mm-hmm. If you're lucky, they're running at 60 hertz, mm-hmm. you know, at HD. And that's just like one eye. So now all of a sudden, like VR is like not even 90 hertz, and you gotta like, you know, render two eyes stereo, and there's all these other processing requirements that are going to force the degradation of the image quality even further. So I was like my holdup. But this, you know, this Presence plugin, and then there's
more than that. There's also the idea that we were exploring this with only 3 degrees of freedom, right, for the mm-hmm. VR, and then we really want to, you know, that works up to a point, but I don't know about you, but I get really nauseous if I don't have 6 degrees of freedom.
Yeah,
you know, for an extended period of time, right? So the Presence system was a very interesting one that came up to us, and they created this box you could put your head into. It was kind of weird. Like you put your box, you know, it's like putting your head inside a box, and suddenly everything around you is.
And within that box.
Within that box, it looks like you're inside of another world, right? It's like going into the holodeck inside this box. And you can't get out of it. The box is not big. It's 1 meter by 1 meter by 1/2 meter. But it's enough that you can bob your head around and it looks like you're around this area. And the other key factor that they did is this is not done as rasterized rendering. Mm-hmm. It is done as actual data that's coming out of, in our case, V-Ray.
Yep.
It's V-Ray data that's rendered and that it looks that way. They do some special tricks to make it work for all of the little factors, including some of the view-dependent things. But it's pretty darn good.
Yeah. I mean, it looks and feels like a V-Ray render
right.
in 6 degrees of freedom.
Yeah.
And so you're immersed in this world that is as photorealistic as you as an artist are capable of generating.
The thing that fascinates me is because basically they've created a version of Construct inside of NoZone. Mm-hmm. The thing that was fascinating is they had to reconsider. They tried to stay as faithful to the short as possible, but they had to completely rethink about how editing was done.
Yeah, so that was a big question. You know, what do you do with editing in VR?
Yeah.
You know, everybody's asking the question, and everybody, you know, people are still exploring solutions to it. Mm-hmm. One other thing is that we implemented with this Construct VR version. So basically, we created an 8-minute version. We abbreviated version of the 12-minute short right. in VR, you know, using Presence. And all of this cost or savings efficiencies that we had done, it's like shooting 40-second long performances and cleaning mm-hmm. it up before I actually shot cameras. So basically, that means I have fully animated performances that worked pretty well from a certain distance that now yeah. I could think about re-editing it in a VR context. I didn't have these 2-second animation clips and then nothing. I had 40-second long
or cheats to camera.
Exactly.
We didn't in animation normal cap did we cheat the camera? Because we again the forethought Kevin had was like we know we're gonna wanna be able to
yep.
see this from multiple angles.
Yeah. So now okay, back to editing. You got these long takes but you do want to cut to draw attention every now and then. So when first of all editing, you want to slow down a bit. You don't want to cut every 2 or 3 seconds like a take in film or whatever. You got to give some time to, you know, let the viewer absorb the current angle. Mm-hmm. But whenever there was a cut or an edit and like we were being transported to a different location in the environment and being oriented to focus on a certain perspective, anytime there's a cut, wherever you were looking in the previous cut is the whole world is reoriented and aligned. So at the start of the cut, you know that you're looking where the director is intending you to be looking.
Right.
Very quickly, you come to accept that idea as a viewer.
Yeah, and I adapted very quickly to it.
Yeah.
So I can't say that that's been the case in a lot of VR content. A lot of VR content just tries to lock off the camera and make you witness the whole thing. And I don't, so I always equate it like, I feel like, and they try to address you because they're trying to make you part of the action, but mm-hmm. I just feel like that awkward, you know, guy that's brought on stage of a Cirque du Soleil thing where you're like, what's going to happen to me? You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's just kind of a little weird.
Some French clown is going to start laughing in my face. I'm going to feel really strange. That's the way I feel a lot of the VR stuff. Uh-huh. But this, I was like, nope, I am. I felt third person, but still immersed at the same time, because I think that's the draw there that I think is very interesting. And the editing felt completely natural at that point. It was really interesting, really interesting.
There's a few things I think we're still exploring, like the concept of scale, you know, where if you cut, like, you know, you can experiment with the scale of the world.
Because you're still placing a camera somewhere.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, you can put the camera foot off the ground, you know, then all of a sudden
then you feel like you're sunken into the ground.
Yeah. So, you know, learning, you know, but it's fascinating to be able to kind of create like a narrative piece of content, you know, that you know, is cohesive and plays across time in a VR setting. And looks as good as what Presence can deliver.
Yeah. It was really great, and it was, you know, it was nice to be able to maintain the quality that you already set from the short throughout the whole VR experience, as well as, you know, the narrative and the editing and the music and everything. So really great.
And there's other stuff I'm experimenting too, like the Neuralize guys with Atom View. They're developing some really cool virtual production like suite of tools.
Uh-huh.
Like, for instance, if Construct it goes forward, it'll be like a live action film.
Yep.
I want to do location scouting months at the earliest in pre-production as possible, LiDAR scan everything, bring these point clouds back into this VR context and use virtual production tools, you know, with my cinematographer and the actors and, you know, whatever key, you know, team members, stage the scenes, figure out what we need to do so that when we go back to the live action set, to shoot that day, we're that much more prepared and ready and we can get through it that much more efficiently.
Yep.
That's exciting.
Yeah, Mr. Metzger is into his point clouds for sure, and those are great. Those are really, really good stuff, and you can fit a lot of data in point clouds for sure. Okay, well, that's great. Is there anything else you wanna mention to people or tell people to check out? I mean, obviously, go to this podcast page. There's going to be a ton of links in there with tons of behind the scenes looks and all these videos. I'm going to put all that stuff in there that we have.
Yeah, I'm sure we'll get the social media stuff up and running, and I want to keep feeding some behind the scenes videos, you know, after we release.
Do you have a webpage
set up? You could do constructfilm.com, kevinmargo.com, and you could find me on Instagram through kevinmargo.com. I'm not sure what I'm doing yet with that, but we'll figure it out very quickly.
Okay. All right. Well, that's great. So a lot of people can go follow you at those places, constructfilm.com, kevinmargo.com. And what about you, Darren?
Well, you know, I would say we just keep it focused on the film. I mean, if people want to follow me on Instagram, I'm just Darren R.
Okay.
On Instagram, it's really more about the film.
Yeah.
I'm not really worried about. I'm not worried about my social media following here. You know.
Yeah. Well, that's great. Well, thanks you so much, and you know, it's been awesome. You know, I know you're a producer on the film as well as I'm a producer, and I'm very, very proud of having contributed to this or help out on it. And it's one of those projects that really comes from a visionary. And I think you did a really amazing job envisioning these things, which is, you know, what a visionary does. But I really am thankful for being part of that project for sure.
And I'm incredibly thankful of working with, you know, you, Chris, and Darren and Chaos Group. And I'm having a partner that believes in what we're trying to achieve and is help reaching that goal has been incredibly rewarding.
Cool.
Well, you guys are both like, you know, the geniuses, the mad scientists behind all this stuff, you know, and Kevin, I've said this before, Chris, you've heard me say this before, like Kevin's a polymath, especially on the short. I watched him absorb new technology like overnight, you know, from like cloud rendering to you experimenting with the 3D back when I think what Douglas Trumbull was.
Oh God, we didn't even mention Doug Trumbull.
I always run out of time to talk about Doug Trumbull.
Which, that was crazy figuring all the 3D out, and I was like, what? And all that stuff. And so for me, it's been watching an incredible amount of magic literally right next to you and be like, whoa. And Chris, it's always great. You know, it's awesome the support you give and how positive you are and all the stuff that you do in the podcast and what you guys are creating from a technological standpoint is amazing. And so I thank you.
Thanks, Darren.
I feel lucky to know you. I feel lucky to know you guys.
I just because we always run out and we have just a little, I'm just going to mention anyway. We worked with Doug Trumbull.
We should mention that.
Yeah, who was, and this came up, this again, he said, this is why it's taken 5 years, because all these things come up and they distract us, right? Doug Trumbull, who was the visual effects supervisor on 2001.
And Blade Runner, and I think one of the Star Treks, and directed Brainstorm.
Close Encounters?
Maybe Close Encounters. Yeah, right. Yep, Close Encounters, too.
He did?
Yep. Yeah. Well, I don't know if he was VFX, but he partook in it. I think he was.
Okay, well, anyway. Yep. Legendary man.
Totally.
Yeah. created a new standard, that he's been pushing, called the MAGI system, which is 4K stereo, 120 frames a second.
I think he calls it MAGI.
MAGI. Yes. Yeah, MAGI. So we calculated that it's 40 times more pixels than an HD frame at 24 frames a second.
Right, yeah. So he was looking for content. So we took that 1 minute teaser and we rendered it as MAGI spec so he could like demo it to, you know.
1 minute of content rendered essentially would have been 40 minutes of content.
Yes, so which is almost half a feature film of a traditional 2D Disney.
We rendered it on a VCA cluster.
In like 1 week.
1 week.
Yeah. It's
crazy.
Bam.
40 minutes of CG in 1 week, basically.
It's like butter.
I still remember the first shot that Kevin put together 3D with the glasses. I'm literally animating next to him at his house.
Yeah. That's right. He said, send me a picture. I remember that.
Right. Yeah. And he, I see like peripherally, he puts these glasses on and all of a sudden he just goes, whoa. I'm like, what? And he's like, dude, check it out. And I put the camera on. I'm like, the glasses on. I'm like, whoa. And it's when Bill is staring at the guys, the robots dropping the human in the cement.
Right.
And it's like the POV of the robots back at Bill. So three-dimensionally, you see like all this depth of Bill standing there and the wooden frames. You could see the leaf on the branch beyond him. I'm just like, damn, man. That was cool.
I have another funny story about this. Doug Trumbull needed a place to show the short, right?
Yep.
And he was asking me, do you know any place that I possibly do this? And so I asked my wife, because who works at Photocam, I said, what do you think, the Photocam would have a stage to do this stuff? And they kind of wanted to get into this stuff. So she introduced people to the right people. Doug Trumbull got in touch with Photocam and they went in there, et cetera. So now I'm going to go see Doug Trumbull over there. I want to see the short. And I walk into Photocam, and they know me because of my wife, or at least the producer, but they didn't realize that I was the person that brought this in. It's like, oh, hi, Chris, what you doing here? It's like, I think Karen's up. So it's like, no. And I go into with Doug to get a thing, and I walk in and I said, wait, what? And I said, I'm the producer on this. And they're like, oh. It's like, so yeah, it was pretty funny. But yeah. That's cool. Yeah, and it was really amazing to see that, because seeing that spec sounds a little insane and overkill, but when you actually see it for real, it's
for very animated different. Content, it really works very well.
Right.
You know, you watch, like, I think the video game generation is more acclimated to these high frame rate things. I mean, they're playing video games at 60 hertz all the time.
Or more.
Mm. And it happens to be CG and animated, right?
Right.
So, you know, applying that format, that viewing experience into, you know, a theater, you know, setting or a narrative content setting. I think very quickly, you know, that generation absorbs this and there's something like fantastical and hyper real about.
Well, I had this conversation with Doug specifically speaking, and there's a philosophy behind this. I guess we're going a little deep on it, but that's fine. There's a philosophy behind it that I think that was important, right? Because I talked to him and I was like, I didn't like 48 frames a second Lord of the Rings or a Hobbit, because I thought it looked like, you know, a sitcom, right? Didn't feel right, doesn't feel like that, because sitcoms are 30 frames a second, or the way they were, you know, General Hospital was shot. Doesn't feel cinematic because we're used to that frame rate feel, right? The way things look. But what he said, I agree, and I think that's not the right thing, but that's not what the projector does. The projector refreshes at 120 frames a second, right? It's a 120 hertz projector. That's what they do. So when you're shooting 24 frames a second, it's actually playing one frame five times, and then another frame for five times, and then another frame for five times. So he said, why not give it a unique image for every refresh rate, and then it'll be the natural process of what that process can do. And this is not the 120 hertz stuff that your TV does, because that's all interpolated right. and looks like crap. Mm-hmm. But this is the actual 120 frames. And it does look like looking through a window.
Yeah, yeah. And it, I mean, he's got some patents on it. It's like crazy because, you know, if you think about like a traditional film that's converted into, you know, 3D.
Yep.
I think even most like 3D films that are shot, they're firing the shutter at the same moment in time, I believe. This is not Magi. Like all the other ones, like Prometheus, I think, where basically the shutter is activated in both cameras at the same time, right?
Right.
So the right eye is capturing the same moment in time as the left eye.
Right.
But when you go into theaters, the right eye is actually projected half a frame later, right?
No, half a cycle later.
Half a cycle later, right?
Right. So 1/120th of a second later.
Mm-hmm. So I think that leads to eye strain, where your right eye is always seeing something that actually was, you know, half a moment in time sooner.
Right.
You know, so like Doug's like specs resolve all that, where he's alternating the times of capture from left to right eye.
So your right eye is the frame rate of the right eye is a half a frame behind.
Mm-hmm.
So did it. Temporally speaking, it's basically 120 frames a second.
Right.
Which is quite.
And it works.
It looks amazing. It looks amazing. And there is no eye strain. It is literally like looking out a window. And it's a little, it's breathtaking, honestly. Yeah. Yeah. But it's also 40 times the rendering.
Just call up NVIDIA and you're set.
Yeah. All right. Okay, well, then I'm going to end it there, guys. Thanks so much for doing this. This has been great. And it's dinner time, so let's go grab some dinner.
All right, let's do it.
Thank you, Chris.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Chris.